This is the Winchester Talking Newspaper for the week ending Friday, the 11th of May, 2018. Hello and welcome to this week's edition of the Hampshire Chronicle from the Winchester and District Talking Newspaper. Liz and Gordon Legg have edited the extracts this week. We'll begin with the usual regular notice, and the first is to say, if you know someone who's sight impaired and would like to receive our recordings, or if you have a problem with the recording you've received from us, please telephone Irene Dowding on 01962 870 370. That's 01962 870 370. And as you listen to the recording, please remember that you can use the buttons on your box to move on from an item before it finishes, or back to any of the tracks if you want to listen again. And one more reminder for those of you with computers or tablets. As well as using your memory stick in the box, you can also access the weekly recording of the Chronicle through our website, www.winchestertalkingnews.com. That's all lowercase, no spaces, www.winchestertalkingnews.com. You just need to go to the website, click on News on the header bar, locate the recording you want to hear, and click Download. The recordings are listed in date order, with the most recent first on the list. And so let's look at this week's edition of the Chronicle. Our readers today are Claire Porter.
Hello.
Nick Kearns.
Hello.
Tony Bergstrom.
Hello.
And Nick and Tony are very kindly covering for Richard Martin and Jerry Tuff, who are both on holiday. Thank you both. And so I am your presenter, Ros Lydiard. And on with the news. The first headline will be "The Tories Cling On to City Council." Jobs boost for city, TV chef selling home near Winchester. And so, Claire, for the first headline story.
Tories cling on to city council. Winchester Liberal Democrats enjoyed their best electoral night in years, coming close to snatching control of the city council after taking two seats from the Tories. After years of being second best, they were just 80 votes from becoming the biggest party. Had just 42 people in the Colden Common and Twyford ward switched from voting Tory to Lib Dem, then control would have changed hands. The biggest cheer at the end of the count at the River Park Leisure Centre early last Friday said it all. The Lib Dems were hoping to complete a hat-trick of wins, but the Tories narrowly clung on to Colden Common and Twyford, and so retained control. The hurrahs at 3:55 a.m. were more than tinged with relief, as it meant they now have 23 seats in the resurgent to the resurgent Lib Dems 22. Sue Cook retained Colden Common with 996 votes, 84 ahead of the Lib Dem challenger, Hannah Williams. At the start of the campaign, the Conservatives had been four seats ahead, but now they retain power because they took a seat from an independent, the former Tory cabinet member, James Burns. Lib Dem leader Lucille Thompson said, "These have been great results. We have tapped into the concerns of residents about Winchester. We are edging ever nearer to taking control." The Lib Dems last held power in 2010. Residents feel this council is very distant and that they don't engage with people. People think they are being neglected. People are asking what is happening in central Winchester. "We hit a chord. It is very shabby, and people are concerned that a number of shops are leaving. We are concerned about the Buttercross. It is not being cleaned, and there are those awful concrete blocks in the middle of the high street, she said, referring to the anti-terrorism barriers. Winchester, according to the Sunday Times, is on the naughty step, she said, referring to the regular lauding of the city and the national press until its recent slippage down the league table. The biggest surprise was the victory of Lib Dem Linda Murphy against long-serving Ian Tate. Councillor Murphy said, "I think people wanted a change. Our glass recycling campaign helped as well." Councillor leader Caroline Horrell said she was particularly sad to see Mr Tate lose his seat in St Michael Ward and a place on the council he has held since 1999. She said, "I am surprised. We have lost an outstanding councillor in Councillor Tate who knows the city inside out and back to front. I'm saddened for him." Mr Tate said pro-European Union Conservatives had switched to Lib Dems. "A lot switched their vote. They are more pro-Europe than those living in the villages." Steve Brine's attitude to Brexit did not help. The Lib Dems ran a nasty campaign, telling Labour voters they were wasting their vote. He said he hoped to come back in the future. "I feel I have done as much as anyone to say that Winchester cannot be an exclusive city. It has to be inclusive." The Lib Dem vote in the ward soared from around 400 in 2016 to more than 1,000. The biggest battle was in St Barnabas Ward in the Week area, where Lib Dem Anne Weir held off a strong challenge from Paul Twelvetree, who had campaigned on stopping the diversion of Andover Road through Barton Farm. The turnout of 54% was the best in the district, where the average was just 40%. Mr Twelvetree said the whole ward, apart from the houses on Andover Road, was opposed to the closure and diversion. The election was notable for the complete disappearance of UKIP. In 2014, the protest party polled more than 3,000 votes. This time, their only candidate got 52. At Alresford, Margot Power was delighted to return to the council. The former councillor, who had served for 5 years, was able to take advantage of the retirement of long-serving Ernie Jeffs. Councillor Power, chairman of the town council, said, "I'm chuffed to bits. I think it's because I get things done." She also praised the work of fellow councillor Jackie Porter. Also at the count was James Burns, the former senior Tory councillor who became an independent. He had attempted to rejoin the Conservative group before the election but was rebuffed. However, he attended the count sporting a Conservative rosette.
Jobs boost for city. Hampshire County Council is preparing to launch a major jobs boost in Winchester. The authority will take on 100 new staff in the coming months as part of its shared office scheme, in which it provides other public sector organisations with back office services. The new staff will be employed by the Council's Shared Services Partnership after it won contracts from 3 London boroughs. Councillor leader Roy Perry says the profits made from the contracts will be put into local services. The move comes just 8 months after Hampshire announced it faced an anticipated budget shortfall of £140 million by April 2019. And a range of services, including recycling centres and lollipop men and women, were under threat. Councillor Perry said, "With ongoing financial pressures and the challenges of having to deliver a lot more with less money, all areas of the public sector are faced with finding smarter, more cost-effective ways of doing things." It's never been more important to look for opportunities to collaborate. To do just that, we launched a groundbreaking shared back office public sector partnership. The objectives for sharing these services have been to reduce costs, create capacity for the future, and develop a model that can expand and take on new partners, enabling organisations to reduce their back office overheads and increase resilience so resources can be targeted to the delivery of local services, making better use of limited public funds. Councillor Perry said the scheme had helped the council avoid compulsory redundancies and keep a good employment level. He added that the scheme was now the biggest of its kind in the UK, with the addition of the three London borough councils, would now support more than 90,000 staff. The council will launch its recruitment campaign between now and autumn. Liberal Democrat Councillor Mark Cooper said he was very much in favour of bringing new jobs to the county. However, the Romsey Town Ward member feared the scheme could reduce the standard of services provided for Hampshire. He said, "The thing that would be my concern is that the authority looks after its own services. It's already hard enough for councillors to get things done in the county." In 2015, a report by the Local Government Association showed councils have saved almost £500 million by sharing services with each other since 2012.
TV chef selling home near Winchester. A celebrity chef who launched his career in Winchester is selling his seven-bedroomed home, which is so pricey estate agents haven't disclosed its price. James Martin has placed his home at Stoke Charity on the market. It has been reported that the 45-year-old has lived at the property for 9 years and is looking to move on. The home has been placed on website onthemarket.com, where it is the only home currently available to buy in the area near Sutton Scotney. According to the website, the home is an old dairy house and since being bought by Mr. Martin has been extensively revamped. No price has been published, but media reports say the asking price is £3.75 million. There is storage for his large collection of classic cars and motorbikes. Mr. Martin moved to Winchester while still in his early 20s and was the head chef at the Hotel du Vin in Southgate Street in 1994. The hotel, arguably Britain's first boutique hotel, was launched that year by Robert Hudson and Gerard Bassett, and other hotels were bought before the chain was sold in 2004. Mr. Martin had left the hotel in 1996 and moved into TV, where he became a star on Ready Steady Cook, Saturday Kitchen and Saturday Morning, and took part in Strictly Come Dancing in 2005, where he came fourth. For some 15 years, he co-owned a delicatessen in the square with his friend Alex Edwards, but it closed in 2012, blaming rising rents. He's also published a number of best-selling books and written columns on motorising for the national press. Before moving to Stoke Charity, Mr. Martin lived in a three-bedroom flat above shops on Winchester High Street, near the Law Courts.
And we have the death notices for you now for the week ending Friday the 11th of May. Ball, Irene Lillian Renee Ball, passed away suddenly on the 30th of April, aged 93.
Benjamin, Helen Mary Benjamin, passed peacefully in her sleep on 28th of April, aged 88.
Bert, Stacey Burt, passed away in hospital on the 2nd of May, aged 84.
Strafford, Judy, Countess of Strafford, peacefully at home on the 4th of May, aged 88.
Edwards, the Very Reverend David Lawrence Edwards, OBE, died on the 25th of April at Sunrise Senior Living, aged 89.
Haddock, Roger Michael Haddock, died on 24th April, aged 90, and remembered with great love by his family.
Hardman, Christine Vera Hardman, sadly passed away on the 28th of April, aged 77.
Herkett, Edward Leonard Len Herkett, passed away on the 24th of April, aged 71.
Nettle, Robin Nettle, co-founder of Winchester Garden Machinery, on the 5th of May, aged 69.
Philpott, Gladys Emma, nay Harris, Philpott, passed away on the 2nd of May, aged 101.
Pothecary, Eric William Pothecary, passed away peacefully on the 1st of May, aged 88 years.
Smith, Geoffrey Smith, passed away peacefully on the 27th of April.
Thank you, and Claire now is going to go on with Christian comment, please.
This is headed today, Ascension, the Fourth Great Festival, and is written by Rosemary A. Baker. Thursday the 10th of May was Ascension Day in the Christian calendar. The Feast of the Ascension is one of the four great festivals of the Church's year, along with Christmas, Easter, and Pentecost. It marks the end of Jesus' life on earth and his return to heaven. In many countries, namely Austria, Belgium, Denmark, Finland, France, Germany, the Netherlands, Norway, and Sweden, it is a national holiday. In other countries, including Britain, people now take little notice of it, and many in the secular world may be unaware of its existence. But in times gone by, churches would be crowded at service time on this major festival. Today, even some churchgoers seem uncomfortable with the concept of the Ascension, while in other churches, in order that it is not totally neglected, it is transferred to the next Sunday. It comes at the end of the 40 glorious days, the period of rejoicing that follows Easter and counterbalances Lent. During those 40 days, as the Gospel accounts tell us, Jesus appeared on several occasions to his followers. Then, as we read in the Acts of the Apostles, on the day we now call Ascension Day, he led his closest friends to the top of a small hill just outside the city of Jerusalem. There he repeated his promise made before the crucifixion that he would not leave them comfortless, but that the Holy Spirit would be with them always. Then, we are told, he was lifted up, and a low cloud covered the hilltop and hid him from them. When the cloud lifted, he was gone. As heaven was commonly believed to be in a place literally above the earth, there developed the belief that he had ascended. To symbolise his physical departure from the earth, the Paschal candle, which is lit in many churches at Easter, is extinguished at ancient tide. It is a day of rejoicing that Christ's work has been completed. In less scientific times, congregations had no trouble with its literal interpretation. It is a feast of great antiquity. Although no proof dating earlier than the 4th century exists, St. Augustine spoke of it originating in the time of the first apostles. It is frequently mentioned by St. John Chrysostom in the 4th century, suggesting it was then a well-established observance. Important though it may be, few social customs have been connected with it. Although it was probably a time for blessing the crops before the rogation days became established. Ascension Day was also the day on which many communities conducted the ceremony of beating the bounds. In Derbyshire, well dressing still happens at this time of year, one of the most famous ceremonies being at Tissington on Ascension Day itself. It is a way of giving thanks for the water supply. For those who followed Jesus, the time between the festivals of Ascension and Pentecost was a time of waiting and wondering. In 2016, the Archbishops of Canterbury and York initiated a movement called Thy Kingdom Come, a period of 10 days between Ascension and Pentecost, when we are invited to pray for God's Spirit to move within the church, equipping us to share God's love with others so that they might also know Jesus. This has now spread globally and to all denominations. And this was written by Rosemary A. Baker.
Thank you very much, Claire. And we're moving on to letters to the editor, and there really is quite a big mixed bag of letters this week. We've selected 12 for you, and Tony will start it off with the first, please. Thank you.
This one's from Valerie O'Leary and is headed Shoddy Work. Sir, it would be interesting to hear from Hampshire County Council why, when repairing a pothole at the entrance to Woodland Mews in West End on May the 2nd, they omitted to repair another one less than 10 yards away. This pothole had been notified to them and was marked accordingly. So why was it not repaired at the same time? Surely the council have a system of knowing how many potholes there are in certain area. This would again seem to be a total waste of public money, as obviously another lorry with four workmen will be sent to repair the pothole in West End Road. I await their reply with interest. Valerie O'Leary, Woodland Mews, West End, Southampton.
And the next one's entitled Andover Road. Sir, I have held off writing this letter until the local elections were over, but it alludes to your editorial comment of April the 19th, in which you criticised some Conservative city councillors for changing their stance on closing Andover Road, a stance that for good reasons had broad support from all political parties and other major players in the city. The chief culprits here were Councillor Horrell, the leader of the council, and the Winchester MP, Mr. Brine. Your comment, with which I agree, implied that the change was purely for electoral reasons. Happily, the tactic did not work, but that does not absolve the leader of the council from being so irresponsible. Here she is in charge of solving significant problems of planning in Winchester, yet showing that her judgment is severely lacking. Her undoubted charm and ability to chair a meeting cannot make up for her obvious lack of strategic good sense. The same could be said of Mr. Brine. I do not think that Wintonians take well to political craftiness and lack of principle. May I suggest how they might redeem themselves? I propose that they knock together heads of Hampshire County Council and Winchester City Council so that they produce a traffic plan for Winchester before the plans for Silver Hill and the station approaches are finalised. Nothing will work unless they do. My own view on that plan, and many are of the same opinion, is that it must prioritise traffic-free streets and park and ride. I know that this approach is not favoured by some people living outside the city who want to park inside it, but it is the essential ingredient for promoting a city that will be attractive both to vital small retail businesses as well as to citizens, shoppers and tourists. It is a formula well tested for similar sized cities in other countries. And that's from Jock MacDonald, Stockbridge Road, Full Flood, Winchester.
This letter, headed Question of Bias, from Peter Hargreaves. Sir, possibly clouded by the bias you always demonstrate to my letters to the Chronicle, for whatever reason, you totally failed to illustrate that the main point of my letter was to deplore the secrecy of the Men's Health Charity and Councillor Martin Todd to declare what he's paid in salary and expenses, and which they are still refusing to do. I would remind you, sir, that as the editor of a newspaper, it is your job to fully express your opinions, but it should be, as any editor would tell you, in your editorial comments column, and not to interject in debates between correspondents in the letters columns, particularly with indications of bias. David Batty boasts that it's his first letter to the Chronicle. He should be ashamed. His inaction is indicative of members of the establishment and political elite who continually escape sanction for their management incompetence due to those who are too laid back to complain and who only finally resort to the letters column after receiving assistance with a planning application. After serving 15 years as a Metropolitan Councillor, I'm fully aware of the demands on a councillor's time, and I can tell the other writers that no elected city, county councillor and Winchester city councillor holding a full-time position and involved in local politics can possibly fulfil his duties and responsibilities to... fulfil his duties and responsibilities to his constituents. If Councillor Todd has spare time outside of his employment and doesn't know how to fully use it, I'm prepared to take him by the hand and show him all the things that sorely need his attention at the County Council and in his Winchester City Council ward. Councillor Todd and the Men's Health Charity can put an end to this argument simply by disclosing the information requested. If they don't, then surely even their uninformed supporters must conclude there is something to hide, and this demonstrates a gross disrespect to the charity's supporters who put up the cash and to the people of Winchester. When and if I receive the information from my Freedom of Information request, I will make clear my reasons for doing so. Peter Hargreaves, Worthy Lane, Winchester.
No fresh voices, heads a letter from Catherine Hutchinson. Sir, it seems that Winchester has consigned itself to more of the same following the City Council elections on May the 3rd. We remain entirely in the hands of the Conservatives and the Lib Dems. Fresh voices, which could have pressed for social justice and sustainability, sadly remain outside the council, not inside it. For many, Winchester will remain a pleasant place to live and work, regardless of its politics. But this cannot be the only measure of our city. We lag behind on sustainability and recycling. Tory austerity has wiped away our children's centres, threatened services in our hospital, and has increased the need for food banks. If Winchester is to be a good place for all, we need to address these issues in local government as well as being comfortable with success. However, standing as a candidate for Labour in the elections and watching the count revealed just how high the comfort level is in our two main parties. There was a complacency about the outcome. The Lib Dems, as always, buoyed by the gift of a strategic vote, elicited by their mantra, "Labour cannot win here." I think this is a cruel piece of strategic advice at heart. It effectively says to those most affected by cuts, to those who want change, you will never have a voice here, and we are comfortable with that. In fact, while canvassing in my ward, I found that many who would like to vote Labour were it not for this strategic advice. For the present, whether inside or outside the council, Labour will continue to be their voice. Meanwhile, perhaps it's time to bust that Lib Dem mantra and make things a little less comfortable. Labour is working to win around Winchester. Catherine Hutchinson, Labour candidate, St Paul's Ward, Fordington Avenue, Full Flood.
Labour upbeat. Sir, I would like to thank the huge number of people who voted for their outstanding Labour candidate in the Winchester City Council elections last week. We fought a very successful campaign. Members worked tirelessly over many months, and our overall share of the vote increased. More importantly, the electors who voted Labour put their trust, faith and determination in the value and belief of Labour candidates to balance the terrible one-party system on the council. I use one party quite deliberately. Many voters expressed the view that they could not vote Labour because they had to vote Condemn to keep the Tories out. This rationale really beggars belief. There is no difference between either party. The Condems went into coalition with Cameron's hard-right Tories at the drop of a hat. They supported the infliction of poverty and austerity at every turn. Their present leader gleefully supported the wholesale privatisation of Royal Mail, adding to the list of assets stripped from public corporations and sold to private enterprise. As Oscar Wilde said, a pessimist is one who, when he has the choice of two evils, chooses both. A Condem vote is a Tory vote, make no mistake. We will regroup, reflect on our achievements, and build upon our solid votes this year in preparation for the next election. I sincerely hope that the National Labour Party will have addressed many of the issues still causing concern by the post-Brexit 2019 local elections. This should not detract from our national success in winning 77 more UK council seats, 44 more than the Tories. However, the overwhelming strategy for the UK in relation to recent results is that Mrs. May now appears to have a clear mandate for a hard Brexit driven by the extreme right in her party. This will have the most damaging consequences for the people of Hampshire and the UK. Be careful what you wish for. And that letter's from Peter Rees, Chairman, Winchester Labour Party, Monarch Way, Winchester.
This letter from Eileen Berry is headed Immigration. I thought it would be a good idea to put things in their right perspective with regards to immigration. Consecutive governments, Conservative or Labour, have misled us. We were told in Edward Heath's time that belonging to the common market was for trade, and we believed it. The rest, of course, is history. Each government, for whatever reasons, have left our borders open. We're not talking about closing off our borders to immigrants. Illegal immigrants is the key. We are a small island. We have this problem of housing, and it will grow bigger. It has to, unless we decide to limit those that we take in. As far as I am concerned, those that have been here and lived with us since after the Second World War have helped this country enormously. We're not talking about those that are integrated. We're talking about the flood that was allowed to come in. Our National Health Service is under strain. Our housing, yes, we are building, but who are we building for? Not my grandchildren, they can't afford it. Now, as I speak to people in my surgery, which is in the street, they are frightened to give an opinion in case they are called racists, and that is sad. We are told that our elderly are suffering. We are almost at a standstill with special care, or indeed any care. One has to remember, most of the elderly have worked all their lives and paid into a system. If you look into history, most civilizations seem to turn on their own people. And God forbid, it seems this is what is happening now, and I am very concerned. Eileen Berry, Priors Dean Road, Hairstock.
Blame Warfare on Cars for Closure is the headline from a letter from Nigel Goodeve Docker. Sir, it is with great sadness that I read in the Chronicle of April the 12th of the closure of Wild Sports. It is yet another example of the loss of a very special independent shop which had served the community well for many years. It was a shop that provided help and assistance for parents and then older children alike. I suspect that much of the problem lies through systems such as Amazon and the difficulty for private independent shops to match their power. It could be said that that is a measure of the times. However, one of the attractions of Winchester was the fact that it had independent shops of this nature. But now the steady loss of these shops, plus the awful and expensive parking arrangements, is driving many people away from Winchester, other than tourists. The short-sightedness of the local council, both in terms of the rate charges and the constant warfare on cars, is bringing about the end of Winchester as an attractive place to shop. The fact that Winchester, for the time being, has a number of attractive cafes is neither here nor there. The times are indeed changing, but Winchester will come to rue the loss of shops such as Wilde's. Nigel Goodeve Docker, Chilbolton.
Phil Yates writes on bus memories. Sir, it couldn't have been more perfect. On the hottest bank holiday for the annual running day for the King Alfred buses. The day brought back happy memories for me of bygone years riding on these vintage buses. I was fortunate to pick out a Leyland Tiger Cub dating from 1959 for a ride to Sparsholt, Route 7, for which this bus operated all those years ago. I was also in luck to have as the driver James Freeman, the chairman of the Friends of King Alfred Buses, who told me he purchased this bus in 1981. A bonus was to have as the conductor David Scheuer, now 87, who was a conductor on these buses from 1956 to 1973, when the company was handed over to the Hanson Dorset Bus Company. A day full of nostalgia to remember. I should like to thank James Freeman and his team for organising such a great day and to all the drivers, conductors and stewards who worked so hard to make this a special day for Winchester citizens and visitors who had travelled great distances to be with us. Phil Yates, Tower Street, Winchester.
This letter from Robert Shields is headed Spelling Lesson, and I hope I give it properly. Please may we set the record straight on the spelling of Bishops Waltham, the town, and Bishops Waltham, the civil parish. The town has an apostrophe, the parish does not. Look at any ordnance survey map. The spelling of the parish is recorded by the Local Government Boundary Commission, England, as Bishops Waltham from the early 1970s, and a Winchester City Council statutory instrument, 1985, number 154, on changes in local government areas, had a map of parishes which shows Bishops Waltham. The designation of the town of Bishops Waltham is much less formal, but convention has always been to include an apostrophe. There you have it. The town of Bishops Waltham is in the civil parish of Bishops Waltham, and that's a fact. Robert Shields, Hoe Road, Bishops Waltham.
It Takes Two is the heading of a letter from Geraldine Guthrie. Sir, I was so sad to read that Mr. Roper has returned to Australia with such a poor impression of the friendliness of those attending Winchester Cathedral, Chronicle Letters, May the 3rd. During the comparatively short time we have lived in Winchester, we have been met with nothing but friendship and kindness from those in the cathedral, both clergy and congregation, and have ourselves met some wonderfully interesting people visiting from abroad and elsewhere in the UK. Unfortunately, with such a large congregation, it is often difficult to ascertain who are regular attendees and who are visitors. And, of course, not all people like to be spoken to by strangers. I've made mistakes on both counts in the past, and it is also a pity that Mr. Roper didn't take advantage of the opportunity to speak to members of the clergy who stand at the south door and often also at the west door to specifically speak to members of the congregation as they leave. However, it takes two to start a conversation, and if Mr. Roper had hovered on the edge of a group at coffee, or had made the effort to speak to a couple or someone else standing alone, then he might have been able to return to his local church in Australia with a different and definitely more accurate impression of the friendliness of the people who attend our lovely cathedral. I am sure, however, that Mr. Roper's printed comments will have been noted, and that even more effort will be made by regular attendees at the cathedral services to speak to those standing alone. This is from Geraldine Guthrie, Milesdown Place, Winchester.
Room for All. Sir, following Professor Robert Adams' letter last week and his comments on style, letters May the 3rd. If the buildings in our new streets are built on roughly 10-metre plots and the heights are substantially varied to ape the skyline that already exists, then the architectural styles can be happily diverse. The streets can absorb all styles, that is, the vernacular, the classical, the traditional, the contemporary, and the fashionable. This muddle of styles is what makes Winchester, and it should continue to be so. It also gives the opportunity to have many architects working here, not just one massive practice. And that's from Hugh Thomas, Southgate Street, Winchester.
This letter, headed Pain is Good, from Jeff Naylor. The teachings of business schools have given us the economy we enjoy today. They have taught students that financialization of the real economy produces the maximum return in the shortest period. They have also taught how to abnegate individual morality to the system. This received wisdom enables the public to understand that even financialized, self-created adversity is good for the economy, and hence us. Jeff Naylor, Birch Close, Colden Common.
And thank you all very much for those letters. And moving on now, the roving reporter asks the public if they approve of 25-year-olds being given £10,000 to help buy a home, invest in a business, or put toward a pension. Nick has their responses.
Yes, and the first one is from Patricia Bucknell, 56, carer of Highcliffe Road, Winchester. She said, "It's a good idea, but it should be a range, like 25 to 30 initially, to make it fairer. My 29-year-old daughter lives with me, and if there was a way to help her get her own home, I would welcome it. Fawney Bridge, 17, a student of Southington Lane, Overton, said, "I like the sound of that. Getting £10,000, I think, could make things easier for the younger generation. But I don't think that the pensioners will be very happy." Peter Francis, 69, import expert clerk of Ramsey Road, Kingsworthy, said, "I'm afraid I had to work for my living, and I'm still working now. We give too much away now, and some people need a kick up the backside."
Charming.
Nina L. Haholi, 21, a student of Eastern Lane, Whittle, said, "It sounds like a good idea, but I don't think a lot of people will use it for its intended purpose. There should be a process to make sure that it was being used for something useful."
Well, thank you very much. Now we know. Are we pensioners or not? And now it's about the Hampshire Chronicle's letter column. If you have an opinion or a subject you'd like to air on the Hampshire Chronicle, you can contact them on 01962 860 836. That's 01962 860 836. Or you can email them on news@hampshirechronicle.co.uk. And that's lowercase and no spaces, news@hampshirechronicle.co.uk, or you could also you could also write to the editor at 5 Upper Brook Street, Winchester, SO23 8AL, or you could even drop in when you're in Winchester. Now, Chronicle comment this week. The Chronicle comment is headed turning poacher to protect services. Hampshire County Council leader Roy Perry is understandably proud of his new shared services partnership. It is creating jobs and helping to pay for council services, which might otherwise have to be cut in the facing of reduced financial support from central government. The partnership has just won a contract to do the back office work, that's human resources, payroll, accounts, that sort of thing, for three as yet unnamed London boroughs. Well, that's good news for Hampshire. More employment and less likelihood of the local tip being closed or the nice lollipop lady being laid off. However, what if the shoe were on the other foot? It's likely the outsourcing of these services will cause job losses in the capital. How would we like it if our bean counters were thrown out of work because contracts have gone to Lambeth or Wandsworth? Councillor Perry would argue that employing Hampshire, the London councils are cutting their costs and so will have more money to spend on their services. But is this form of competition really sustainable? How long before the county council is competing against private companies to offer payroll services and undercutting them and putting more people out of work? Shouldn't a council concentrate on its own area, its own services, instead of leaping into this dog-eat-dog world? And now we move to first person, which Claire will read for us, and it's George Hayter, giving us reasons to be cheerful, please.
Indeed. Winchester is one of the best places to live in the UK, according to research that compares life in local council areas. In the last 5 years, we here in the Winchester City Council area have never been out of the study's top five, and in 2016 we came first. I agree that Winchester is one of the best places to make your home in the UK, though I don't fully agree with the reasoning used in the study. The research by the Halifax Bank is based on a ragbag of data, such as life expectancy, education, crime, the extent to which citizens say they feel healthy, and how much people earn. I'm not sure that the Halifax should, for example, include income in its research. High incomes may indicate only that Winchester is attracting high earners to live here. Residents' wealth is not necessarily anything to do with their hometown. They could be commuting to high-paying jobs elsewhere. For me, Winchester is one of the best locations in Britain, largely because of its cityscape and countryside, which are pretty enough to provide an inspiring backdrop to anyone's life. But there's something equally important that makes Winchester a winner, and that's its location. We are living in the ideal county. The importance of being in Hampshire is underlined by the fact that the most consistent winner of the Halifax comparison is another district council in Hampshire, the little-known district council of Hart, hidden towards the northeast of the county, won in 2013, 2014, 2015, and 2017. Of course, Hampshire does have faults. It's an expensive place to live and crowded in some parts. Some Hampshire hogs fret that too much of their countryside is being built over. Dense population has brought heavy traffic and unhealthy air pollution. When we look up at the night sky, light pollution from our cities means we can only see the brighter stars. Most of us would have to agree that it's less friendly down here than up north, and community kindness may be less of a force here than in some rural regions. We're a coastal county, yet we have not one sandy beach. Subterranean chalk means the water from our taps is hard as rock. But Hampshire's strengths are many. Bounteous shopping malls and department stores are a short drive from rolling countryside and sleepy lanes. Every household knows a beauty spot close at hand, and the New Forest provides miles of wilderness. Thirst is short-lived when there are irresistible pubs like the Jolly Sailor, among the brilliant yachts on the Hamble at Burselden, and like the Mayfly on the gently gushing Test near Stockbridge. Its beaches may be stony, but the Hampshire coast, from exciting ports to solitary marshes, offers another stimulating aspect to life in this county. Hampshire's position in the centre of the south earns it a good climate. It's warm in summer and mild in winter compared to the north, and not as wet as the west. Weather here is just about the best in Britain. We are well placed for dashing off to France by ferry, and drivers can reach the tunnel in a couple of hours or so. Heathrow is just up the road, and our own airport at Eastleigh can be handy for a short hop. World-class entertainment and sightseeing in London is not much more than an hour away. The United Kingdom itself is overwhelmingly popular. Russian oligarchs, African young men, you name it. Our wealth and human rights makes them all think this is the best country to live. If Hampshire is one of the best places to live in the UK, and the UK is one of the best places to live in the world, there is an inescapable conclusion. We live in one of the best places on earth. I'll remember that next time I'm complaining about my lot in life.
Thank you, Claire. And moving on now to a letter from Westminster, and it comes from George Hollingbury, and Nick's going to read it for us, please.
Yes. Most political commentators consider the job of Home Secretary to be one of the toughest in government. I was a parliamentary private secretary to a Home Secretary, so I know firsthand this is certainly true. The sheer amount of papers, emails, briefings, conversations, decisions, opinions, actions and, yes, targets that cross the desk of any minister, not just that of a Home Secretary, is bewildering. Can any human actually cope with that amount of information and know all about every decision, right or wrong? Recent events make this a pertinent question, but Amber Rudd's resignation, although sad, is not unusual, especially in the Home Office. During the 13 years of the last Labour government, for example, there were 6 Home Secretaries, and not all left with their reputations fully intact. True, ministers are helped by advisers and civil servants, but the responsibility stops at the door of the one in charge. This particular tenet of government has a name and a long history. Ministerial responsibility is a constitutional convention where ministers are responsible to Parliament for the conduct of their ministry, and therefore government as a whole. It is something that started its evolution back in the 17th century to curb the power of Charles I, and is central to our parliamentary system because it ensures accountability. One might also say it doesn't allow anyone to make a mistake and learn from it while staying in a job and putting right what went wrong. Those who make the mistake are sometimes best placed to put it right, particularly, as in the case of Amber Rudd, there was no deliberate attempt to mislead. On the other hand, some critics feel that ministers no longer take ministerial responsibility seriously and don't fall on their swords often enough when they make serious errors. The history of every government in every country since records began will tell you some people aren't up to the job of governing, when others prosper if given time. So there is clearly merit in both arguments. But aren't we in danger of making it impossible for anyone to live up to the expectations of doing what is considered a good job if we are so keen to seek the resignation of those who make mistakes? Now, I know politics is a brutal business and no quarter is given. Everyone knows the rules and plenty are willing to play by them. However, putting the general desire to take part aside for a moment, do we run the risk of the most able thinking that it's simply too much trouble and the environment just too brutal to enter public life, so they take their talents elsewhere? This is no plea for politicians to receive special treatment or not to be held to account. They very much need to be. I simply think there should be a debate on just how we can be effectively governed when the world is now so complex, so fast-paced, and so quick to judge when something fails. To not think about it could be detrimental to our country. George Hollingbury, MP for Meon Valley.
Lots of questions there, I think. Thank you very much, Nick. And we go to Belgarum now, and Claire has the first, and then it will be Tony.
Counting down on Rachel. TV star Rachel Riley could be on her way to Hampshire after the county's fire and rescue service receive a surprise reply on Twitter. The Countdown TV show regular posted about her lovely day being reunited with Pooches from charity Hearing Dogs for Deaf People before a spokesman for Hampshire's firefighters tried their luck. They tweeted Rachel to say, "Let us know if you would like to meet our amazing fire dogs who have sent arsonists to prison for more than 500 years. We're hoping you will be enticed by the dual attraction of dogs and numbers in the same invite." To their surprise, Rachel responded, "Wow, Doubly exciting. When can I come? It is not yet clear whether a date has been arranged for Rachel's trip. Belgarum will keep you informed.
And now, Tony, please.
Shappi's return. Top comedian Shappi Khosandi has been sharing her fond memories of Winchester ahead of her tour date in the city next month. Shappi, a former student at Winchester University, then King Alfred's College, graduating in 1995 with a degree in drama, theatre and television, will be performing her sell-out Edinburgh Fringe show, Mistress and Misfit, at the Theatre Royal on June the 8th. In response to a promotional post by the Theatre Royal on Twitter, she said, "I get very emotional about Winchester, my pretty uni city. The ghost of a 20-year-old me, drunkenly singing cranberry songs, is still seen by the Buttercross during the Hat Fair. Come on the 8th of June. Meet you at the Buttercross after. We imagine there are a few King Alfred College alumni who remember Shappi's Dolores O'Riordan impersonation, and Belgarum would welcome any anecdotes from former classmates."
Thank you very much. And my Belgarum item is Holly and the Black Mambas. Alsford adventurer and conservationist Holly Budge aims to inspire and educate women globally by telling the stories of ordinary women who achieve extraordinary things in traditional male roles. She is in South Africa, highlighting the work of the Black Mambas, an anti-poaching all-women team. Every day, 96 elephants are poached for their ivory. At this rate, they will be extinct in the wild by 2025. Holly has launched a powerful campaign which presents a physical commentary on the devastating impact of the ivory trade. She said, "I am very excited to immerse myself with the Black Mambas, the first all-female frontline anti-poaching team in South Africa, to intimately learn what drives and motivates these pioneering women. Armed with only the pepper spray and handcuffs, they patrol hunting grounds of poachers who pose an imminent threat to the elephant species. They also strive to change attitudes towards the role of women in Africa." We're moving now to the historical item section, and we start with 200 years ago, which is my pleasure. 200 years ago, on Monday, May the 11th, 1818, a serious disturbance, we are sorry to say, has taken place at the college school near this city. The young gentlemen, both scholars and commoners, with the exception of a few college prefects, at 3:30 on Thursday afternoon, armed themselves with sticks, stones, etc., got possession of the keys and locked themselves within the college walls. The warden, fellows and masters, having refused to treat them on any other terms than an unconditional return to their duty, they, at 10:00 the next morning, delivered up their sticks, opened the gates, and went to their respective quarters. The second item, 200 years ago, on Tuesday last died, after a long illness, in the 50th year of his age, Mr. Pitt, gardener to Lady Milduray of Shawford, near this city, leaving a widow and 10 children.
100 years ago, Saturday, May the 11th, 1918, two boys of 14 and 15 were charged and pleaded guilty with being concerned in the theft of 5 bottles of perfume, the property of Samuel George Bartlett, chemist, of 4 Jury Street. Prosecutors stated that on Monday, April the 1st, He missed 5 or 6 bottles of perfume from his showcase, their value being 12 shillings. The showcase was in the corridor door and could not be seen from the shop. Detective Sergeant Maybe spoke of questioning the boys, and one told him that they went to the shop on Easter Sunday at 10 a.m. and took 5 bottles of scent. They also stated that they went to Southampton, and having used the scent, people remarked how nice they smelt. Laughter. Thank you. The head constable, that wasn't how the officers traced them. More laughter. Both boys were given good characters by their parents. The mayor announced that owing to their good characters, they would be dealt with leniently.
Oh.
And another case. Robert Lane and Robert Kirby, Winchester men, were summoned for trespassing on land in the parish of Easton in search of conies, rabbits. The facts were proved by George Ebsworth, an assistant keeper, who, on the afternoon of Sunday, April the 28th, when in a footpath leading from Winchester to the Fulling Mill, saw the two defendants and a third man, whom he was unable to identify, at a rabbit burrow. There were 2 dogs with them, and the third man had a ferret. A rabbit bolted, and this man caught and killed it. Defendants asserted that they were only out for a walk and that Ebsworth had trumped up the case against them out of spite.
Thank you very much, Tony.
And now we go back 50 years to Saturday, May the 11th, 1968. 5 men were killed when a helicopter crashed in a field of cows near the village of Crawley on Monday. The machine, which appeared in the area at about 11 a.m, crashed only a few hundred yards from the village centre. By the time fire engines arrived at the scene, the machine was a burnt-out wreck. The only remnant was a metal rotor arm jutting ominously from the grass. Charred pieces of metal were scattered over the ground, and the machine itself left a black patch of scorched earth. 2 painters who were working on a nearby house witnessed the helicopter's last minutes. Mr. R.G. Hayter of Mortimer Close, Kingsworthy, said, "It blew up in the air and the propeller came off. Then it just fell to the ground. When I looked over the wall, it was a ball of fire." Also working on the house was Mr. C.J. Barnes of Alexander Way, Botley. He said that the alarm was raised by a woman in an adjacent cottage, and police and ambulances were soon at the scene. The burning wreck was cordoned off from the crowd of villagers, which quickly gathered. Several cows, which were grazing in the field where the machine disintegrated, were involved. They began to run around madly, trying to extricate themselves, eyewitnesses said. The herd of 69 Frisian cows was owned by Mr. Douglas Seligman of New Barn Farm, and 11 of them had to be destroyed as a result of burns. The value of these cows was estimated at over £1,000.
Oh, gosh.
The helicopter belonged to the United States Air Force. And the second item from 1968... Mrs. Cecilia Day, 83, of Telegraph Lane, Four Marks, fought off a youth who tried to force his way into her home last week. Then she walked 2 miles to tell the village policeman, even though there is a telephone kiosk just 300 yards from her home. Police with tracker dogs searched the area after the attack on Friday week for a youth who is described as 5'7" tall, slim with fair hair, wearing blue jeans and a dark blue sweater. Mrs. Day said, "The youth asked for Mr. Day, my son, and stood glaring at me. Then he grabbed me and tried to push me into the hall. How I managed to fight him off, I'll never know, she said.
Well, maybe she's still trying.
Isn't that turning, obviously?
25 years ago, Friday, May the 7th, 1993. Liberal Democrat environment spokesman Simon Hughes, MP, has backed a new legal attempt to save Twyford Down from a government carve-up. Speaking at a meeting held at the House of Commons on Wednesday, he said, "The protesters are not giving up. Some of the most influential citizens in Winchester are clearly still unhappy." Members of the Friends of Twyford Down protest group have filed a renewed complaint to the European Commission in Brussels, citing evidence that the Department for Transport consistently misled the public about the damage that will be caused by the M3 extension. For example, a photo montage of the cutting was far smaller than its actual scale. Mr. Hughes commented, "The lawyers have advised there are good grounds to argue that the statement of reasons previously submitted to Brussels in support of the scheme did not constitute a non-technical summary of the environmental impact assessment of the M3 route." The second section. Hampshire County Council is next to bottom out of the 42 local authorities in England and Wales for providing services for people with learning difficulties, according to MenCap. Chair of the disabilities charity, Elizabeth Hall, said she was horrified at figures compiled by Mike Hancock in his capacity as district officer of MenCap. Mr. Hancock also leads the opposition group on the council, the Liberal Democrats. Mrs. Hall said, "For the first time, there is clear evidence of the inability of the county council to satisfy the demand in providing full facilities to meet the true needs of people with learning disabilities throughout the county."
What's on in the area is our next item, and I'm going to start with one because I have a little bit of involvement in this activity, and it's about the Chesil Theatre, who tells the story of the Land Girls, and it's headed Lilies on the Land, Chesil Theatre, Winchester. They did their bit for the war effort by donning Wellington boots and overalls to take on back-breaking farm work. The girls of the Land Army from all different social classes and walks of life were sent to farms to live rough and work hard to replace the men who had joined the forces. Now their story is told in the next production of the Chesil Theatre, Lilies on the Land. Based on letters and interviews with the original Land Girls, this play is a revealing, funny and wonderfully moving portrait of these unsung heroines. How will these young women, deprived of all basic home comforts, deal not only with the hardships of farming life and the pressures of war, but also with being outsiders in new surroundings? Basic accommodation, ice inside the windows, work clothes full of mice, rough hands out in all weathers, brought about by a camaraderie which means they are looking back and they say they would do it all over again. Director Norma York said, "The merchant navy ships which brought in supplies from overseas were at risk of attack from submarines. It was vital that as much food as possible was given and reared in this country." This play is a fitting tribute to all these women. Lilies on the Land will be at the Chesil Theatre between May the 19th and May the 26th, excluding Sundays, but with four performances at 7:45pm plus a 2:30pm Saturday matinee. Tickets cost £11 and are available from www.chesiltheatre.org.uk. That's www.chesiltheatre.org.uk. No spaces and all lowercase. Next is about the cathedral organist who's going to play in the village church. Leading musicians from across the Winchester area will be performing in one of the smallest churches in the diocese when they take their part in a concert at St Andrew's Church, Oslebury. Andrew Lumsden, Director of Music at Winchester Cathedral, will be joined by David Hall, Director of Music from Twyford School, and soprano Eurel Hall, Director of Music at St Swithin's, Winchester. The concert is, as I've said, at St Andrew's Church, Oslebury, on Friday the 25th of May, with doors opening at 7pm, and tickets are £15 each, including a glass of wine and canapes. You can contact Paul Bowes on 01962 777229. That's 01962 777229. That's for Paul Bowes. Or email Paul Bowes Effivaney at gmail.com. And I'm going to spell all that for you. It's Paul, as in the usual name, P-A-U-L, no space next, Bowes, B-O-W-E-S, Paul Bowes, Effivaney, that's E-F, F for Freddie, I, V, Victor, A, Apple, N, Napoleon, Y, Yacht. So that's Paul Bowes, Effivaney, at gmail.com. That promises to be a really beautiful evening of organ entertainment. And more entertainment for you. Toe-tapping Irish folks at the Concord Club. I'm really excited about this and I'm determined to go. They're called the Kilkennies, the Concord, Eastleigh. And they're a traditional Irish folk and ballad band which has won worldwide acclaim, and they're heading towards Hampshire. The Kilkennies are noted for their dynamic arrangements, energetic performances and charismatic rapport with audiences across the globe. How can you resist that? Now they're set to bring their unique band of music from the Emerald Isle to the Concord at Eastleigh on the 24th of June as part of a United Kingdom tour. And I'll say no more, but to give you the telephone number for the Concord so that you can ring immediately and book your tickets. So it is, the Concord is 02380 653989. That's 02380 653989. Thank you for listening. Before we go now to the general news, I'm going to give you the lighting up times. They're starting on Saturday the 12th of May and the sun will set at 8:44pm. And on Wednesday the 16th of May, the sun will rise at 5:14am and will set at 8:50pm. Now on to items of general news. And Claire, can we have your first article, please?
This is headed Motorbike Tribute to World War II Veteran. Five outriders on World War II motorbikes fittingly escorted dispatch rider Andy Bramley on his final journey. The ride through Coldon Common ended at Holy Trinity Church, which was packed with family and friends who had come to pay their last respects. Andy, also known by his middle name Jim, joined the Royal Army Service Corps aged 18. He landed on Gold Beach on D-Day when the ramps went down. The sea was so rough that they had to put our motorbikes on top of tanks to get them to the beach. Then it was every man for himself. Andy had orders to make his way to Crayoli, where the BBC had set up a broadcasting base in the tower of the chateau. For several weeks, correspondents recorded reports on the Battle of Normandy. The Allied invasion and the launch of the BBC War Report was a landmark in British broadcasting. The newly developed midget recorder enabled reporters to capture for the first time the sounds of battle and eyewitness accounts of men in action. Andy rode up and down the beaches in the midst of the battle, collecting these tapes and photographic films and taking them back to the correspondents at the chateau. Richard Dimbleby was one of the broadcasters based there, having himself landed on D-Day. On the third day, Andy was knocked off his motorbike by a shell when the road he was on came under heavy bombardment. This was the first of many scrapes, Andy would recount, as the correspondents followed the advance from the D-Day beaches through the battle for Caen, the advance through Normandy to the liberation of Paris, the Battle of the Bulge, the invasion of Holland, Operation Market Garden at Arnhem, and eventually to the German surrender. During the invasion of Holland, a staff car Andy was following struck a landmine, killing the occupants. Andy was blown off his bike. When Andy reported for duty, he was told the adjutant had already sent a killed-in-action telegram to his wife. Imagine her surprise when he returned home to Wickham 4 days later. Back in action again, during Operation Market Garden in Arnhem, Andy had another near miss when his bike tipped off a pontoon over the Wyle River. A few days later, as Germans regained control of the area, Andy was stranded on the main road as jeeps of Germans drove past. Initially, he hid behind a newspaper stall until a nun from a nearby convent sent word he should come and hide in their basement. Speaking to the Chronicle in 2015, the then 92-year-old said of his war service, "You do not forget it. I remember every day, and I would think that every veteran you speak to now would say the same." After the war, Andy worked as a lorry driver for the Mearn Valley Timber Company, where he met Iris, his wife of 27 years. He always carried a harmonica in his pocket and was quick to entertain with a tune, a song or a dance, and always had a twinkle in his eye. Andy was a member of the Normandy Veterans Association, the Operation Market Garden Association, and Project 71. Andy and Iris enjoyed trips back to Arnhem and Bastogne with Project 71 in 2016-7, which included a surprise visit back to the basement where he had hidden. On Armistice Day 2016, Andy was presented with the Légion d'Honneur at HMS Excellent in Portsmouth. Andy will be missed and fondly remembered by Iris and his family and his many friends. He was thrilled to know he had been chosen as the poster boy for this year's Southwark Revival, having captured the hearts of everyone there last year as he beamed his way round the village on the back of a BSA, one of the bikes he had ridden during the war.
Assault figures soar at city prison. 6 times more assaults were recorded in Winchester prison last year than 5 years ago, with prison reform campaigners declaring the situation a national emergency. The rise in attacks on staff and prisoners, revealed in figures from the Ministry of Justice, shows the scale of the task faced by prison officers. Of the 369 assaults recorded in 2017, 170 were on staff. 32 assaults were defined as serious, a category which includes sexual assaults and those where victims required hospital inpatient treatment. In 2012, 60 assaults were recorded, meaning a 5-year increase of 515%. The numbers also reveal that 474 cases of self-harm were recorded in Winchester last year, compared to 151 in 2012. Across prisons in England and Wales, nearly 30,000 assaults were recorded last year, more than double 2012. Self-harm also increased by 92% over the same 5-year period, with nearly 45,000 cases in 2017. Francis Crook, chief executive of the Howard League for Penal Reform, said, "This shameful rise in violence and self-injury is the direct result of policy decisions to allow the number of people behind bars to grow unchecked while starving prisons of resources. This is a national emergency and the government must respond boldly and urgently. Positive steps to reduce the prison population would save lives, protect staff and prevent more people being swept into deeper currents of crime and despair." Justice Secretary David Gawk said, "The levels of violence, suicide and self-harm in our prisons are far too high and we are taking urgent actions. Assaults on our staff will never be tolerated. We are ensuring prison officers have the tools they need to do the job. Rolling out body-worn cameras, police-style handcuffs and restraints, and trialling PAVA incapacitant spray." In September, the Chronicle photographed staff entering the jail with riot shields. Though the Ministry of Justice denied a prisoner's claims that control had been lost in three of the prison's four wings. Inmates and their families painted a picture of chaos inside the prison.
Oh dear.
Bid to amend green gas mill scheme. A row over plans for a new green gas mill looked to have been reignited after developers lodged a bid to make changes. The power plant is set to be built in Sparsholt after being given the green light by planners in October 2016. As previously reported, the plans for a mill at Sparsholt Corridge drew objections from seven parish councils, among others, representing more than 7,000 residents. The college claims the plant, so an anaerobic digester which turns grass into gas, can produce power for nearly 5,000 homes a year. It would need 60,000 tons of fuel to do this, which green energy company Ecotricity said would be sourced within a 15-kilometre radius of the college and transported by tractor and trailers. Now, Ecotricity is seeking to make changes to the type of digesters, relocate and resize some of the infrastructure, and change the design and appearance of the accompanying education building, which will be used to train the next generation of engineers. Laura White, project manager, wrote to Winchester City Council planners to say, "The amendments are required following the appointment of a technology provider. Due to the competitive tendering process and patented technology of each provider, it was essential that the approved plans were kept generic for the purposes of securing planning permission." Ms. White added that since the plans were approved, nearly 2 million of potential funding had been withdrawn, meaning the education building would need to be altered. According to Ms. White, the potential funding was withdrawn due to RHI, Renewable Heat Incentive regulations, being delayed. She said, "The design of the building has therefore been revised to deliver a comparable educational facility, albeit at a substantially reduced cost. The revised building would be capable of holding 128 students. However, a new application has opened up old wounds and for some campaigners." Felicity Gillibrand from Crawley wrote, "Whilst we acknowledge the environmental benefits of a biodigester, these benefits will be lost if the site of the biodigester is wrong for other equally important environmental and community reasons." Ian Hay from Sparsholt added, "The education centre was one of the important factors of the application, To ask this to be scaled down in size shows that this is not important to the operation and therefore is not being truthful. To alter the feedstock from green crops to straw is the first stage to applications of change the fuel to household waste, which, based on historical evidence of other digester operations, is totally unacceptable.
Thank you very much. And we are closing down now. Those are our extracts for you for this week. Before we go, there's another reminder that Irene Dowding is the person to call if you have any problems with your recording. Her number again is 01962 870 370. Well, thanks now to all the support teams for the preparation and dispatch of this edition, to our editors, Gordon and Liz, and of course, many thanks to our readers, Claire.
Bye.
Nick.
Goodbye.
And Tony.
Goodbye.
Thank you both for standing in. Thank you. And from me, Roz, until the next time, goodbye. Will you please put the memory stick in the wallet when you've finished with it and return it to us as soon as possible? Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoy your next week. And it's goodbye again. Goodbye.